Please remain seated and keep your arms and legs at all times.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my fellow writers, explorers, and doppelgangers, to episode 13 of The Drunken Odyssey with John King. On today's show, I interview the academic and creative writer Makita Brotman. J.J. Anselmi writes about Lauren Slater's lying, and I dig into some listener mail. Incidentally, I'm really gratified by the mail I receive, in part because I want this show to address your concerns and passions, so please do write in if you have anything you want to say. So what's been happening this week? The fall semester has begun, and more chaos than normal has ensued. The bookstore hadn't stocked enough copies of Writing About Writing, the standard composition textbook we use, and the drop-ad period has seen a lot of roster-altering activity. A significant number of students have missed the first week of class. There's been a lot of emails from confused students who don't have the book, the syllabus, or sometimes even a schedule. I myself am now on a Tuesday-Thursday schedule, which is good in that I have 3 days I don't need to be on campus, but I am commuting quite far from UCF so that I leave to teach at 7 a.m. and I don't really get to stop brushing until 4:15 in the afternoon. In a week or two, I should finally be moving to Orlando. While I'm thrilled about the relocation, the prospect of performing the move makes me a little wary, but there's still more uncertain waiting to do. Tim Foster, my wise and patient editor at Celebrations magazine, reminded me that I had agreed, at what may have been the beginning of last spring, to write a profile of the Morocco Pavilion at Epcot, and that he was now relying on this story for the next issue, and he wondered if, maybe, I could find it in my heart to sort of, kind of, maybe do something so radical as to, say, write this article. So while you listen to this, if you're listening to this the first weekend it's been available, then that's what I will be doing. While I did meet my book review deadline last weekend for the literary review, the edits came back with the velocity of a return serve, and I was up late last night trying to send that back to my editor before she wonders about me. I've got a great short story I want to revise quickly before submitting that to journals, but before I can do that, I need to bail out this boat just a little more so I don't sink. But enough of this madness. Let's get to this week's great interview with Makita Brotman.
And now, the interview of the day.
Makita Brotman is an author, critic, psychoanalyst, and true crime aficionado. She teaches at the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore. Her latest book, 13 Girls, which offers narratives of 13 points of view regarding serial killer victims, has just been released by Nine Banded Books. Congratulations on the new book. One of the reasons why you're my hero is because you are simultaneously an academic writer and also a creative writer, besides having more talents than I can quite imagine. So at what point did you decide to pursue both sort of avenues of writing?
Well, it was never really a conscious decision, but when I was a kid, I really loved reading, and I read for escapism and wanted to just get as far as possible from everyday life and everyday reality. So I was really particularly interested in like gothic novels and horror fiction, but I also read a lot of popular culture like horror comics and magazines, and I didn't really have very much of a direction. I just kind of followed my impulses. And so when I got to university, it was so wonderful for me to be in a place where I could just read and do nothing else except read and talk about reading and be around books, that my only impulse was not to leave. Like, what can I do to stay here, prolong this experience, not to have to go back into the real world and deal with it? So I carried on, you know, I went to grad school and did a PhD, and in doing so sort of learned the game that you had to play, and that you have to develop this kind of rather forced and inauthentic and dry writing style. And even though I was often writing about popular culture, and I was interested in like the high-low culture debate, because the things that I was interested in as a kid, what I wanted to do was see if I could apply the same kind of tools of critical theory to them and see if they stood up, which they did. And this was at Oxford, and it was the time when critical theory was all the rage, and the high-low cultural debate was raging. And it was a kind of interesting experiment for me to see if I could kind of make a case for artifacts that are normally dismissed. But when I started teaching, very quickly that kind of writing wasn't enough for me. It just felt like a kind of artificial exercise that I could do. You know, I'd mastered it, mm-hmm. and I could do it well enough to publish, but it just felt like I was a bit of a ventriloquist going through the motions. And so when I started to write about film, you know, the impact that films have on me is very personal and emotional. And so I started to kind of incorporate my own personal experience into those articles. And then gradually my writing sort of become more and more personal, less and less formal and academic. And now what I'm doing is basically fiction, or a kind of hybrid between fact and fiction. So I'm really interested in sort of playing around with form and genre and, you know, breaking away from those kind of traditional divisions.
You know, I first came to your work through your study of transgressive films, and I was really impressed that you did such smart work on films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Cannibal Holocaust, which for me is usually a touchstone for if you're going to watch those kinds of movies, that seems like a standard of some kind.
It was difficult to write about them because at that time, at least, I think there's a lot more writing now on films that were kind of that were at the time real taboo. But it's difficult because people would either dismiss them or class them as immoral and exploitative and unethical and something that a serious critic wouldn't want to touch. And that really kind of perplexed and fascinated me, because the films were very interesting in their own way. They had a strong impact on me personally. And it just seemed curious that there were certain films that were acceptable and within the, you know, the purview of academic film writing, and then there were others which were sort of taboo and untouchable, as if you'd kind of pick up some disease or infection or something by if you approached them and took them seriously. And so it was interesting for me to actually take this film seriously and, you know, and actually think about genre and structure and plot and narrative and also not necessarily what's going on in the film consciously, but why did they have that kind of cultural impact? Like, what do they say about the culture at the time that they were made and the way that they're received? What does that say about culture in general? And why is it that they frighten people so much? And I'm not talking about people who've actually seen them, but their reputation is so shocking and terrifying to people who consider themselves serious scholars. Like, surely it's not incompatible to be a serious scholar and to study things that are not shown at the art cinema, you know? And I think there's a lot more of that done nowadays. I mean, I'm sure that there's plenty of work on Cannibal Holocaust and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I think, you know, it's a lot more open than it used to be. Is that something you've experienced?
Well, yeah, but partly it's, you know, the work that you've already done that sort of helped open things up. Yeah, now there are sort of regular channels where if you're going to talk about these things, there are already rules, there are already, you know, this history of literature surrounding it. But
I also think that often the most interesting things going on in a culture are not the things that academics tend to focus on. Like, I mean, I watch TV, like when I'm in the gym, or I don't actually sit and watch it, but I get glimpses of it a lot. And the things that are on, like Animal Planet or the home, I don't know what it's called, the one where they like rehab all the houses. I mean, there's some just like really fascinating kind of bizarre cultural things going on cable TV. And I think that those are the kind of places where you find things that reflect a lot more about what's going on in our culture than, you know, the New York Times or kind of mainstream or Hollywood cinema.
Well, there is that really strange thing where, as you said, some movies can deal with taboo subjects, but as long as they have this veneer of a certain established aesthetic that we say, oh, isn't it brave that, you know, Coppola would do something that dark and strange and yeah. and sort of explore the dark side of the American psyche. And yet in Cannibal Holocaust, it's complete garbage because it has the veneer of exploitation films. And even, and you know, its message actually seems to be really explicit. And part of the problem is no one or few people actually seem to be willing to take it seriously because of how graphic it is.
Yeah, and I've noticed the same. I mean, I don't really watch that many horror films that come out now, but I really like The Human Centipede. I don't know if you've seen it, and the second Human Centipede. And, you know, I don't think anyone has really taken that film seriously, but I think it's not an art film, and it's not, you know, it doesn't have subtitles, and it's not in black and white, and it doesn't fit the criteria for a film that's disturbing, but we can also take it seriously. I mean, it's clearly out to shock and disturb and disgust and make money. But still, at the same time, I think there are some really interesting things going on in that film that nobody has really wanted to look at, just, again, because they don't really want to associate themselves with this bizarre and disturbing piece of work.
Yeah, what does it say about me that I want to watch this?
Well, I think you should. I think you'd enjoy it.
No, I'm imagining the fright of other people. I haven't seen them yet. They're sort of on my list, but I haven't gotten around to those yet. I still haven't seen Black Swan. There's like the list of important movies that I haven't seen or interesting movies I haven't seen of the last 5 years or so is pretty staggering.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't see everything. And I think if there's something that's really that you're going to find particularly interesting, you'll make your way to it somehow, you know, whether it's on TV or on DVD. But there's just so much rubbish at the cinema that it's not worth having to plow through this big jungle of rubbish to find these gems that are occasionally lying around.
Well, one thing, I can't even go to the movies anymore because I can't stand watching people look at their phones.
No, so for me, it's... And it's... Yeah, me too. I mean, I just don't like really being in a crowd of people and just having to, like, get there and park and, you know, wait in line and sit through commercials. It's just painful. It's more painful than it's worth.
One of the last films I saw was Halloween 2, and I saw it in Times Square. And my wife was actually so scared after the movie that I had to take her on the Ferris wheel in the Toys R Us store. But
to calm her down?
To calm her down, yeah. When we're sitting, you know, Buzz Lightyear is, you know, on top of our little car and we're going up the, I don't know, it's 3 or 4 stories tall inside the building there in Times Square. And
did you see that when it first came out? Because that was years ago.
Yeah, that was like the last movie I saw in the theater that made any kind of impression on me. Although I think that movie mostly works because of the Foley work. Every time glass breaks, I just remember it sounded so brilliant.
Is that the one where it's in a hospital?
Largely in a hospital, I think.
I
just remember it's Michael's sister sort of being haunted and, you know, we're sort of set up for her becoming the killer for some sort of Halloween 3.
I think I saw that. I think there's a scene where someone gets a syringe in their eyeball, and there's a lot of use of medical equipment for torture purposes, if I remember correctly.
What do you make of the Saw films?
I prefer the hospital films. The Saw films are just like too much fast cutting and editing in almost all films these days. That I like kind of some sustained character development and psychology, and just most films today just don't. There's so much action and so much fast cutting, and it just doesn't give me like a time to hook me. You know, I just don't feel involved at all in the narrative. So the Saw films are just kind of a blur in my mind. I can remember Halloween very clearly and Halloween 2 fairly clearly, but films that have been made in the last 10 years where no shot, it seems to be held more than like 10 seconds, somehow they just don't. They don't have a grip on my memory. They just kind of disappear into the ether. I don't really know why that is. I think it's because no shot is held long enough for me to get an emotional investment, you know, into a character. So I really don't have very much memory. I mean, I saw them. I remember the Hostel films a little bit more clearly, but I don't know. Maybe it's just that films that you see when you're at a much younger age have a stronger and clearer impact on you because you haven't seen that many films. Or maybe it's just that films are but maybe it's just that my mind isn't the kind of mind that can focus on really fast edited sequences and action sequences. I just get completely lost and lose interest.
I don't know. I'm torn by that. Normally, for me, it's if you go crazy, that's okay, in like a really interesting postmodern sense.
Yeah.
But most movies just are doing it out of the sort of postmodern malaise. Like, it's not a postmodern statement. They just happen to exist in a postmodern period where they're trying to overstimulate you because they're terrified you'll be bored. And
yeah,
they don't and, really...
And even when a film starts out well, it seems like there has, you know, there's a kind of formula. There has to be action sequences. There has to be a chase scene. There has to be some kind of action that involves lots of fast movement with the main characters. And, I mean, the horror films that I really prefer are the earlier, I mean, I think Psycho is the pretty much the best film I've made, and my favorite. And just those, like, old Val Lewton films, like The Cat People and The Seventh Victim, and that are just slow and creepy and black and white, and there's no gore or very little gore, but you can actually get involved in the narrative. You can actually, there are the settings and the psychology is sustained enough to build up this sense of fear and suspense, and I just, with a lot of films now, I just don't really get that. I mean, you know, there are some great documentaries and other kinds of films coming out that, you know, more than compensate for that. But I haven't seen horror films recently that interest me at all.
Psycho is a really interesting case, and maybe that can lead us into 13 Girls, because
yeah.
For me, one of the tragedies of Psycho is it doesn't have a high repeatability factor, at least not for me, because
yeah.
You can't duplicate the first time you watch that movie.
Yeah, that's right. But I teach a course on horror films. I'm teaching it in the fall. Surprisingly, there's always, I mean, these are undergraduates. There's always, like, out of 50 students, there's, like, at least 30 who've never seen Psycho. And it's such a joy to be able to introduce that to them, you know, to be watching it in a big amphitheater in the dark with their classmates and have no sense of what's going to happen. But I think even I can still watch it and get pleasure out of it, because I think once you've got over plot shock, you can start paying attention to other things, like, you know, the use of lighting and sound and, you know, just the kind of subtle nuances of the film that you miss the first time round when you're actually so overly involved in the narrative that you can't kind of take a step outside of the film and see it from a kind of objective perspective. And I know that some people think that, my students will often say that they feel like analyzing a film takes away the pleasure of it, that it spoils it, just like analyzing a joke spoils a joke. But I don't find that. I find that if I'm really curious about something, then the more deeply I get involved in it, the more I know about it, the more interesting I find it.
One, I also think it's important who's analyzing the joke.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
And Johnny Carson, whenever a joke wasn't funny, he would make it funny by trying to explain why it was supposed to be funny. And for some reason, it always ended up funny, even when it didn't start out funny. But I guess what I'm referring to in Psycho is just that major plot detour, because the movie begins telling one story. And then once Norman Bates makes that shift, we're in a completely different movie. We're in a completely different story.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took a lot of bravery, I think, to do it that way. You know, I think that's one of the amazing things about your new book, 13 Girls, is how there's not much discussion of the actual murders that take place of these 13 women. Mostly it's about the narrative that intersects the narrative of the killing or are interrupted by the narrative of the killing, or sometimes shockingly, not that much interrupted by the killing.
Yeah, right. I mentioned this in the afterword, but my agent really, really loved it. But she said it was going to be difficult to sell, and she sent it to a lot of major presses, and nobody would really take it on, because everyone, all the emails that she got back that she sent to me said that it was too much, it was too dark, it was too disturbing, that they couldn't read them all. It was, they just left a sense of, like, pain and emptiness and nothingness. And I was surprised at that, because compared to most true crime books, there's almost no violence. There's no graphic details of violence at all. I mean, so I think that the hesitation on the part of the publishers is just that they didn't really know what to do with it, like how to classify it. And also that disruption of genre, like not having someone, a character whose side we're on, like the police or, you know, the grieving relatives waiting for restitution, or the, you know, the the court system looking for punishment or the police solving the crime. Not having that perspective just kind of is more disturbing, it seems, than the most graphic scene of violence, which is interesting. You know, it suggests that reader positioning in a narrative is so important that it sort of defines the genre almost.
And one of the darker aspects of the genre is that normally there's, you know, a detective or a profiler or someone whose job it is to find a killer. And partly it's this chess match.
And what
it does is it takes the human element of the suffering out of the equation. And the more interesting stories like this actually delve into that and what the cost of doing that to yourself is. I think obviously of Thomas Harris and the Hannibal films, although, yeah, that middle film was just pretty unspeakably bad. Considering all the talent that was involved, only Hollywood could put that talent together and then come up with a movie that bad. But
was that Hannibal Rising?
No, that was, I think it was just called Hannibal. But David Mamet worked on a script, Ridley Scott directed, and Julianne Moore took up Jodie Foster's part, which Jodie Foster seemed to have the good sense to just walk away from. It was one of those perfect storms of bullshit where you just go, how did that happen? And so your book doesn't have that perspective of the detective. Yeah, the hero, like who's going to save the day? Well, these women are dead. There's no saving the day. And sometimes...
I don't know what the percentages actually are, but a lot of crimes, if not the majority of homicides, are unsolved. So the traditional kind of positioning of true crime is anomalous, you know, and the true crime label is kind of a misnomer. I mean, there's not a great deal of truth in those stories. They're not typical cases. And I myself read a lot of true crime books, and I often have the same difficulties. I'm very interested in the beginning. I'm very interested in the crime and the kind of peripheral details around the victim's life and the incident of the murder and then the grieving family. And then, you know, which in traditional true crime is like the first maybe 50 pages of the book. And then we get the involvement of the police, and then we get introduced to the perpetrator, and then about halfway through the book, we get to the court scene. And that's usually where I stop reading and put the book down, because none of that has any interest for me. You know, I'm not really interested in the solving of the puzzle and the bringing to justice. I'm interested in all those details that you just glimpse, you know, in traditional true crime, and that I have, in 13 Girls, I've tried to get rid of everything else except those details. And I can see that some people just will find it difficult and disturbing and won't really know what to do with it. Because, as you said, for people who are on the outside of a murder, who may have known the victim casually or have just met her or have been an acquaintance with her, the truth is that sometimes, you know, it doesn't have that much of an impact, that life goes on pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, that was pretty effective, I think, in Chapter 12, Vicky, where there's a casino nurse.
Yeah,
this narrative is one of many, including just the petty frustrations of working in a casino.
And like, that's a good example, because it's someone she's just met, she kind of liked her, and then she's caught up in the police investigation. But that's not to say that the rest of her life isn't going on and that there are other things going on in her life and other things that she's involved in. And within a couple of weeks, the investigation dies away.
And the fact of the investigation and the disappearance seems to be more important than, oh my God, what happened to my new friend?
Right, exactly. And I think that's, you know, however depressing it might be to think about that, that's generally how we live. We can't help being invested in ourselves and the part we play in any tragedy or drama, rather than the experience of the person who has gone missing, who we can't know what they're feeling. And if we didn't know them very well, we can't really empathize too much. I mean, it's very hard for anyone to get out of their own frame of mind. In fact, I think it's impossible. And if you're touched just very obliquely by a crime like that, then the excitement and the upheaval of the case is probably going to be more, it's going to be more interesting than daunting or depressing.
But you also have narratives here with points of view of the opposite of course, people whose lives are damaged forever by this event. You have two narratives here by mothers.
Right.
And then you have, I hope this doesn't make me sappy or weird, but this really touching story of the very loyal boyfriend of a street whore who
partly he's freaked out that he has no prospects of how does he even live the next day because she was his means of support. But also, you know, you get the sense that he's ruined forever. And one of the remarkable things about this book is just the variety of points of view. Were you thinking of Wallace Stevens's 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird when you came up with the number 13?
No, I wasn't. It's just an unlucky number, I guess. I was thinking of superstition. And actually, although it's, you know, there's no way that anyone can say that it's an uplifting book, the 13th girl does actually get away. So there is one escape in the book. But no, I wasn't thinking of the Wallace Stevens poem at all. Actually, I'll tell you what. There's a book by Calvin Trilling called Killings. I don't know if you know that book. I don't know if it's even still in print. He writes about a series of murders. Each chapter is a different murder. But what he's really interested in is the effects that the murder had on the local community. So he's really writing about society and culture and the economic conditions of, you know, particular rural towns. And I recommend it if you haven't read it. He uses each of these murders as a kind of, like, tool to get into the social and economic conditions of a particular time and place in America. And these are true crimes, and it's reportage. The names and the details and are the same, are factual, but he's not so interested in his facts. He's more interested in the community that the crime arose from and the people it affected in that community.
So a little bit of Truman Capote, but taking out the emphasis on the killing.
Yeah. Are you thinking of In Cold Blood?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
In Cold Blood, it takes a while for the actual murder story, I think, to fully take hold.
Yeah, that's right. I love that book, and I love the build-up to the murder. And again, the details of the Clutter's life and the farm itself and what we find out about each of the individual family members and the build-up to the crime. I mean, to me, that's just the most compelling part of the book. The stuff about Dick and Perry afterward in prison is less interesting to me, because it's a bit more traditional, and I'm not so interested in the known fact. You know, I'm interested in things that we kind of glimpse out of the side of our eyes that might or might not be important. There's something kind of numinous and mysterious about details of a crime scene that may be irrelevant or may be really important. I mean, one of the things that really influenced me in writing this book is reading court transcripts and therapy transcripts. And I think once you get something in the form of a transcript, especially a police transcript or a court transcript, then it's like a shift of perspective, like the camera moves. You see things from a very different perspective, and they become sublime. You know, they're elevated, and they take on this mysterious aura that they didn't ordinarily have. Like, if you imagine what you did yesterday, and if you have to go through explaining to a policeman, you know, what time you got up and who you encountered and what you remember about them, and just the ordinary details of an ordinary day become really freighted with meaning. And I found that at the beginning, in the first half of In Cold Blood, but not so much in the second half.
What we're really after, I think, when we read narratives like this, is the revelation of human character. And right. So, you know, what we were looking for is what the killers thought about this. And I don't know that the killers thought enough about it. And I certainly don't think we get it much in Cold Blood. I'm getting my horror.
Yeah.
Getting my names mixed up.
Yeah.
And what we were hoping for is probably something that we got in Dead Man Walking, where we do get some sort of actual reckoning from the guy who was involved in this.
Yeah. And one of the reasons why I have, in 13 Girls, kept the perpetrators out of it, kept them off stage, is because it turns out that, as you're saying, with Hickok and Perry, is that usually these are not well thought out crimes. The perpetrators are not Hannibal Lecters. They're just very kind of banal thugs without very much forethought and planning. And once you see it from that perspective, the crime becomes reduced to something dull and everyday. Yeah. And I think by taking out that aspect of it, it can become a bit more mysterious, and you can have a bit more kind of play with the events and circumstances and the relationships between the person who's missing and the people who remain. I'm interested in how, like, when someone goes missing, or particularly a young girl, because I think young girls are the sort of highest currency in our society in archetypal terms, that, you know, the princess is like the holds the seeds of future generations. Mm-hmm. So when someone like that goes missing, they become fetishized, and people begin to obsess about little details of their lives, and they just take on a far bigger role in their absence than they ever did in their presence. I used to watch a lot of court TV. I don't think it's even called, it's called True TV now, but I remember one cases that I was following was a woman who vanished on the day before her wedding, I think. It was like a runaway bride. This was like maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And there was like a nationwide search, and helicopters and cadaver dogs were called out, and there were all these appeals on the television and radio, and people were saying, you know, we'll do anything to have you back. You know, maybe you've just got cold feet. There's no need to apologize. Just come back, and all we want is for you to be safe. And it turned out that, yeah, she did just have cold feet, and she came back after these appeals. And very quickly, people were very, very angry with her, and the state, I think, sued her for, you know, all the resources that they'd put to use in the search. So in a way, it's almost as though when a missing girl is found, she suddenly comes back to life size and is responsible and perhaps even culpable. But as long as the girl is still missing, then
she's somehow responsible for our hysteria.
Resonance.
It's like she's supposed to be responsible for our hysteria.
Yeah, that's right. That's
over
right,
her
yeah.
unwillingness or inability to live up to princess status.
Right. That if nothing mysterious at all has happened, it's suddenly like everything just crash lands and, oh, we're back in this banal everyday world where there is no great crime, there is no great mystery, and it has the feeling of a huge disappointment.
It's sort of brushing up against a lot of those truths that we don't talk about much that I think comes across very clearly in this book. And partly it's just the variety of perspectives that you write from here, where you do offer what I think is the narrative that we expect, that, you know, the grieving mother, that you don't abandon that and say, well, no, that's not important. But you also include sort of people who normally are forgettable characters in other narratives. I think of the really bizarre and funny deposition that happens in the Louise chapter, where an elderly meth addict had found the body and the police have to interrogate him. And, you know, he's fairly honest about his life as a homeless man.
Yeah, those are the parts of the narrative that are actually true, but don't get into mainstream. They don't get into the true crime genre. I was just talking about this with a friend, actually, that there's a high proportion of addicts who are happy to be addicts and aren't trying to get off whatever they're addicted to and have lived that way for most of their lives and will continue to do so and perhaps live long and functional lives. And we have this narrative in our culture that you're either healthy or you're an addict. There's nothing in between. There's no casual using or heavy using. It's so easy to pathologize. And I just wanted to look at the truth, which is always a lot more complex than that. That for some people, for this guy, the substance that he's using, it actually helps him. You know, it's kind of functional. It means that he doesn't have to work or eat so much or... He's pretty dysfunctional, but this helps to make him a little bit more functional. And so, you know, it's not an important part of his role, but I just wanted to suggest that once you look closely at these peripheral characters, they can be much more complex than you perhaps first assume. You know, in a true crime narrative, he would be like the drifter who found the body.
Exactly. He would be a prop.
Be named.
Yeah, he'd be a prop. He really wouldn't be a character.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's a good way of putting it. It's like looking at the props in a stage set that aren't normally looked at and putting them in the forefront of the stage. Like, what if we paid attention to what we assume is actually a piece of scenery in the background and it turns out to be a complex living creature?
Who's not necessarily waiting to be cured of his addiction.
Right.
He knows who he is, and at his age, he doesn't feel like changing.
Right. He's not affected by this event. He is affected by it. He's shaken up by it, but he's lived a tough life, and it's not going to change him, and it's just, you know, it's another unfortunate event in his life.
Well, and I also like the characters of the police in there who are playing this really interesting game where they're being comforting. It's not exactly good cop, bad cop, but they're comforting him and they're trying to draw him out, but they're also reminding him to tell the truth and to be honest. And meanwhile, he's coming out with all kinds of things which a sensible person might, you know, not bring up. But they still keep plying him and pressuring him to be honest and tell the truth because they're not sure he's not the killer at this point.
Right. And again, once you get something in the form of a transcript, it takes on these kind of resonances that it might not have as dialogue. So it becomes a lot more serious and things are spelled out. allows you to kind of second guess everything. You know, that's one of the things I was trying to do, is to play around with forms, a hybrid of different forms. J.D. Ballard talks about what he calls invisible literature, and these are like the kinds of things that people don't normally think of as literature and don't normally pay attention to rhetorically, like advertising or the copy in catalogs that sell equipment, or, you know, transcript, court transcripts, police transcripts, things that have their own particular form and style, but they're instrumental and functional, they're not rhetorical. And that's the kind of rhetoric I wanted to pay attention to, those invisible literatures that normally don't get much attention.
In this collection, you've got a homicide report, you've got a deposition, you have an intake report and therapy notes from a psychiatric clinic. I believe there's another chapter with other
two of those
therapist notes, and you actually have a sermon in here.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I have to do a couple of readings from this book because it's just come out, and I'm set to do a few readings, and I'm not very good at reading out loud, but I think I'm going to do the sermon because it's easy to read aloud, meant to be read aloud.
How difficult was it to decide the order of these?
It was kind of an intuitive process. I mean, I didn't write them in this order, and I knew the story I wanted to finish with, which is the one where the girl survives. And after juggling them around for a while, I thought that the first one, people who read the first one, which is based on the David Berkowitz case, told me it was very strong, and that would be a good opener. And then after that, I really wanted to just make sure that there was variety and that, you know, the two particular kinds of narratives didn't follow one another. And so there's no chronology or anything. I mean, the dates are very different. And unless you're like a real true crime buff, you're not going to recognize many of these cases. So, yeah, it's not in terms of like particular serial killers or particular eras in time or anything like that. It's just to give the pace and variety. And I think people who've read it say it's a really fast read, that you can read it in one sitting or two sittings.
Oh, it's an incredibly fast read. And, you know, there are 13 different narratives here, but reading them feels very much like a cohesive whole. I mean, this feels like a real book and not like a writer showing off, like, look at what I could do with points of view.
Yeah. And that was another problem I had with publishers. It's not short stories, and it's not a novel, and it's not true crime, but neither is it entirely fiction. And I think so much depends today on marketing, that when you have something like this that's not immediately marketable, and it's very hard for a publisher, let alone a bookstore owner, to decide where this goes, it's very hard to publish it. And that doesn't say anything about the experience of reading it, which I think is, you know, like you say, it sticks together. It's a pretty cohesive whole.
Do you feel like being a woman has also made this more difficult for you, considering the subject matter, in terms of marketing, in terms of getting the book sold?
I mean, a lot of the, you know, most successful true crime writers are women, but a couple of people have asked me, like, why did you just decide to focus on girls? Like, there are a lot of serial killers who kill men, like Dahmer or Gacy, for example, very famous serial killers who didn't touch girls. And I think it's a couple of things. One is it's just easier for me to empathize with women, and I found it easier to write. I mean, the stories aren't all told from a female perspective, but the absences are all young females. And secondly, it's that kind of archetypal thing. It's commonly known, I mean, it's people complain about it all the time, that when a young blonde white girl goes missing, there's all kinds of alerts and panics about them in the media. Whereas, you know, just this week in Baltimore, there's been like three or four homicides, and most of them are black male drug addicts. And as we were saying before, that is a rhetoric of dismissal, you know, that they were assumed to be asking for it or involved in drugs or violence or gang warfare, and culturally they don't count, whereas these girls, each of these girls count in just the weight that culture gives to those particular individuals. But no, I mean, why do you ask that question? Do you think it's less common for women to write this kind of thing?
No, not necessarily. It's a friend of mine is a really good novelist, and I know that sometimes women writers just come up against this difficulty of publishers want to market books by women to women in ways that are sort of pre-programmed for that. And she had a novel sabotaged by the efforts of the publishers, and she was getting hate mail by women going, I hate this. And she goes, yes, I know you hate that. Like, it wasn't meant for you. It was meant for like a more literary crowd. And so partly I'm just...
Yeah, that's right. I have a friend who's just finished a novel and he's having trouble placing it. And his agent said to him, like, the main character is a middle-aged male, and his agent said, oh, it's mostly young women that buy novels these days, and this character isn't going to be appealing. And I just thought that was baffling. I mean, as if you can only identify someone who's, you know, who's like yourself. But, you know, when I was writing about horror films, I'd often get reviews that assumed that I was male. And I'm not sure why. I guess they just assumed that men are more interested in horror films than women are.
Well, I don't mean to make a political point about it. It was more of a question.
I'm curious.
Because it is one of those, I remember, you know, on the subject of True Romance, the Tarantino scripted film, that they had a problem getting an R rating only because of the scene where Alabama is attacked by the hitman. And the censors were upset that she sort of became a monster when she got into the fight with him and managed to kill him. And she's sort of howling like a monster, you know, crazy in pain and somehow exultant all at once. And they said, well, you can't show that. And for that to be the way that they drew the line on violence upset Tarantino, upset Tony Scott, like it upset, and it upsets me, like it still upsets me that we have this weird standard that we're only going to allow honesty in certain ways.
It would be interesting if it were not just so ludicrous and peculiar. I try and keep away from the mainstream media because I just have no, I just don't really understand it. I don't understand the mindset of the people who produce film and television these days and who write for the press, but it feels like it's people who are of a different species almost. Like, who could be offended by that? Something that is so, you know, so real and so honest and truthful. It's baffling.
Well, I think this goes back to your interest in horror films because, you know, that scene, probably more than any other, is why that movie exists. And people would rather take that out of the movie. No, let's just watch the men beat each other up and sell the drugs and be badass weirdos. When that's part of the movie, but I don't think that's like the point of the movie.
And I think I can imagine, you know, when we were talking before about the podcast, I can imagine that it's very, very difficult for a writer who has literary interest to have to navigate what often seems to be the small-mindedness of editors and agents and publishers. But personally, you know, I've always had an academic job, so I've never relied solely on writing for income. Writing has always been an extra and something that is, I've never set out to make money from or wanted, well, I'd like to, but I've never intended or geared my work towards making a profit. So, and I think that there's more and more small presses and alternative presses and, you know, self-fabrication is becoming much more acceptable. And I think that it is depressing, but there are also ways in which writers can kind of get around those blocks and publish things that are subversive. I mean, this 9-banded books that published this, 13 Girls, is a very small press. And yet, I think that the care that's been taken with the format and the design and cover and is not something I would ever get with a big press. So I was disappointed that a big press didn't take it on, but I never have had this much involvement in the book or worked with someone who cares so much about it and has so much, you know, personally invested in it. So, you know, it does make a difference.
And I think it's great that there is, you know, that there are independent publishers out there who can find just really brilliant work like this. I wish you all the best with this.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much.
And now, a book discussion, a book that changed my life.
A Powerful Truth by J.J. Anselmi. I believed psychological diagnosis to be a viable explanation of identity when I started Lauren Slater's Lying. 2 years before, hopelessness slithered through my bones and muscle tissue as I cried alone, convinced that, although I'd been clean for 3 years, excessive LSD and marijuana use had caused permanent psychosis. Prozac, coupled with narratives of healing attached to diagnosis and medication, curbed these thoughts and provided a sense of equilibrium. I've been doing well in my English studies before, but on Prozac, my thoughts and writing became more lucid. Long hours and my warehouse job passed more quickly. Major depression, I told myself, as did my psychiatrist and therapist, was the main cause of my drug abuse and psychosis. It was the true explanation for social alienation I experienced throughout my adolescence. Finishing my book-length memoir about drug abuse, depression, and music, 1 year after completing my BA in creative writing, I read Lying. After depicting several seizures, and vivid auras, a hallucinatory state following a seizure, which seems similar to an LSD trip that occurred throughout her childhood and adolescence, Slater discusses being diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy. But, like the existence of her diagnosing psychiatrist, Dr. New, whether or not Lauren Slater actually has epilepsy quickly becomes suspect. She says, "The summer I was 13, I developed Munchausen's on top of my epilepsy, or, and you must consider this, I ask you please to consider this, perhaps Munchausen's is all I ever had. Perhaps I was, and still am, a pretender, a person who creates illness because she needs time, attention, touch, because she knows no other way of telling her life's tale. Munchausen's is a fascinating psychiatric disorder. Its sufferers, makers of myths, are still somehow true. The illness, a conduit to convey real pain." A few pages after this passage, she exasperatingly says, "You can fake epilepsy. I admit I sometimes faked my epilepsy, but I also really had it." In a following chapter entitled How to Market This Book, Slater, who has a PhD in psychology from Boston University and has worked as a therapist, articulates one of her purposes for writing Lying. "It is a book that takes up residence in the murky gap between genres, memoir and fiction, and, by its stubborn self-position there, forces us to consider important things, such as inevitable fictionalization in memoir and the possible validity of metaphorical or narrative truth over factual truth." As Slater's actual diagnosis becomes slippery and unknowable, emotional seizures from a detached mother and raw, sometimes humiliating, sexual experiences with boys, herself, and an older writer at a retreat become more significant. Essentially, epilepsy as a metaphor becomes more valid to Lauren Slater's life than epilepsy as a factual diagnosis. In a short afterword, Slater says, "Illness, medicine itself, is the ultimate narrative. There is no truth there, as diagnoses come in and out of vogue as fast as yearly fashions." I wanted to throw the book against the wall. Clinical definitions and explanations of depression had become a foundation upon which I built my identity. Desperately, I argued with Slater's ideas. Slater further writes, "Line up all the DSMs, the book from which mental health professionals draw their diagnoses, and you will see how they have changed, how they have radically altered from decade to decade, depending upon the zeitgeist. In this time, right now, in psychiatry, there is a quiet revolution taking place concerning depression. The current story is that depression is a disease springing from a biochemical imbalance. The new story forming is that the evidence for a biochemical imbalance is very poor indeed, and depression may in fact have negligible chemical origins, and so the pendulum swings back." Thinking about and arguing with Lying during upcoming months, major depression, in the context of explaining my thoughts and actions, explaining myself to myself, began to dismantle. Simply pointing to depression and saying, "That's why I am who I am," I realized, oversimplifies social experience. To improve myself and reach out to others through writing, social experience and the way I've reacted to those experiences are richer paths of exploration. I used to believe psychiatry revealed unalterable facts about humans and our identities. Lying, augmented by a teacher and a close friend, illustrated the extent to which psychological diagnosis can be a dead end when attempting to construct, explain, and examine identity in creative nonfiction, unless, like Slater, you use diagnosis as a vehicle to approach metaphorical truth, rather than an explanation in itself, instead of reinforcing widespread cultural narratives, which using diagnosis as an explanation of identity, both on and off the page, does, I now think good literature should complicate narratives people use to structure reality. I recognize the importance of attempting to alleviate mental illness, which necessitates categorization. Clinical treatment for depression has helped me in significant ways. For my sister, being diagnosed as bipolar and subsequent treatment has probably saved her life. But Lauren Slater's purposeful complication through both form and content of truth and the ways we construct it reminds me that any explanation of human thought is, at best, partial and uncertain, which directly contradicts the certainty commonly attached to psychological diagnosis. Regardless of diagnosis, I still have to exist, and I still have to attempt to construct meaning out of my existence. For my MFA thesis, I am completely rewriting the 350-page book that, before I started grad school, I thought completed. My original conclusion for this book, which immediately follows a psilocybin-induced suicide run, advocates the existence of a true self, which translates to a preordained identity. My true self, I conclude, is someone who can't use recreational drugs at all, an identity built in part upon my interpretation of straight edge, because my depressed personality will inevitably lead to addiction. This conclusion, which I used to structure the preceding addiction coming-of-age narrative, I realized is empty. In one way, it creates a false sense of I was lost, now I am found, since I found my true self through sobriety and psychological diagnosis. Life is simple, which is bullshit. The idea of a true self, or soul, ignores the possibility that identity is an accumulation of social experiences and reactions to those experiences. Basically, that we consciously and unconsciously craft our own identities, which is the premise from which I am rewriting this book. This new premise has forced me to more intensely examine drug use. My father, who has gotten high for my entire life, and his emotionally detached family, being a heavy metal fanatic and musician, sexuality, masculinity in Wyoming, and several other things in attempts to pinpoint how these experiences have affected my construction of identity. As I have become skeptical of psychological diagnosis as a way to explain who I am, the ache of despair, despite still taking Prozac, has begun to slither through my bones again. This ache is a reminder that, as a writer of literature, my job is to stray from and complicate easy explanation, which, on several levels, lying accomplishes. Reading, writing, and playing music, for me, are the most effective ways to deal with hopelessness. At the same time, art's valuation of uncertainty is an invitation to despair, a risk I embrace. A Powerful Truth by J.J. Anselmi was read by Joseph Longini.
Drunken Odyssey Mailbag.
Right now we are listening to, if you can believe it, music by the Tequila Worms. They are a fantabulous surf rock outfit hailing from Southern Cali. Rock to them, my drunken Odysseans. Make love to their sonic joys. Just don't swallow them. The Tequila Worms are generously offering their album Cantina as a free download on their website. See this week's show notes for the sweet link. Let's open the mail here. Amy Barnacle writes, "Hi, John. How can writers continue to find a spirit of play with their writing in terms of finding the fun in it, the whimsy, the reckless abandon, the joy? So much of my writing seems so uninspired and rudimentary. This girl just wants to have fun." Well, Amy, the first step is to have a frozen margarita or maybe just a Mai Tai. Really. But another suggestion is to try writing something you feel like you have no aptitude for writing. Write a poem, or a porno story, or a detective story. When Yaroslav and I discussed Stephen King's On Writing, way back on episode 6, we did the homework King gave his readers, to write this thriller-slash-horror scenario, and the sheer wretched silliness of the scenario actually led the both of us to some interesting results, and I think my writing actually evolved from that exercise in terms of becoming more economical with words, with finding ways to write shorter sentences, despite how very capacious my brain tends to be. So write something you never thought you would write. It also helps to read things that are outside of your routine. Go exploring. Or if you're too tired, you could just drink 3 margaritas and dance in the backyard to the tequila worms. There's also a kind of zen about exercises besides writing that can be helpful. Crosswords, jigsaw puzzles, coloring in coloring books, and chainsaw juggling can all get the mind out of that bureaucratic business-like uses many of us put our writing minds to so much of the time. The stimulation refreshes us when we do approach writing. Such is my humble advice. My pal Christy Murphy asks, "What do you think about writers who commit to a daily word count rather than a daily schedule, and how do you maintain either idea of a schedule when committing time to revising?" I do think having a routine is important if you want to write and actually finish writing books. I like the idea of a schedule more than a word count, but that preference really comes down to temperament. I know I freak out and don't stay in the moment if I'm thinking I must write 2 decent pages in the next 2 hours, when if I just write for 2 hours, I might write between 1 and 5 pages. But if you're capable of getting into a staring contest with your monitor for hours on end, then simply observing the time won't help you. Remember that so long as you have some sense of a book structure, then bad writing is better than no writing at all. You cannot revise what you never commit to typing or scribbling down. As for revision, I think the same rules apply. If you're likely to fritter away the time, then merely keeping a schedule won't help. I do think that when it comes to revision, you should outline what you've written to see if the structure seems to hold up. Otherwise, you could be polishing paragraphs that you might end up cutting. After that, so long as you keep moving from chapter to chapter every few days in revision, you should be fine. Of course, like many people, I don't actually have a regular time when I can count on writing. My life is simply overloaded most of the time, so when I do get some daylight to work in, I try to work like a bastard to make some progress. If my eyeballs aren't stinging from exhaustion and I actually do have time to work on my writing, I don't get writer's block. If my eyeballs are stinging, I try anyway. And sometimes the work revives me. Otherwise, I take pity on myself and try to sleep. And then, just as often as not, inspiration comes, and it seems like a synonym for a satanic, if productive, bout of insomnia. Anastasia Golio succinctly asks, "Best way to prepare absinthe?" I covered the topic of absinthe on episode 2's mailbag. In my own drunken opinion, the legendary green stuff is overrated and seemed to just assume the grandeur of the Bohemians who poured it through their magic sugar spoon on their way to an opium den. There's no need to turn boozing into some sort of wonky black mass, kids. Drink for the joy and the fun of it if you can. Let it make your life tolerable. Well, Anastasia, since I didn't really offer a satisfying answer to your absinthe question, let me try to console you with my favorite cocktail recipe. It's something of a Drunken Odyssey secret. Hold up your right hand and swear not to reveal this recipe to anyone, although you are encouraged to actually share the drink at will. I am speaking of the recipe for a drink that was mixed at the Jet Center Lounge, which was my favorite place in the world when it was open. Now this drink was 22 ounces of sweet out-of-this-world heaven. Now I'm told by Mike Jones, who was the proprietor of the Jet Center Lounge, and he is my docent of drinking, that this was a punch. This is my favorite drink in the world. Here are the ingredients. Mix in equal parts light rum, dark rum, orange juice, pineapple juice, and nearly an equal part of grenadine. Once it's all mixed and you've poured it into a tiki mug or even a Tom Collins glass, add a dash of bitters. And here's a prudent word of warning. Your local liquor store isn't likely to carry bitters. My preferred brand is Regan's Orange Bitters No. 6, which is available on Amazon.com. That's where I get mine. And lastly, I've got a message here from Olivia Kate Cerrone, who has contributed to this show several times. She writes, "Hi John, I just got back from Art Farm, a residency for artists and writers out in rural Marquette, Nebraska, and wanted to drop you a quick line about my time there. Let me start off by saying that this was my third experience in an artist colony, and I feel so grateful to have been able to participate in such opportunities. You've discussed before on the show the challenges involved with balancing a serious writing life with the responsibilities that come with being an adult. And I have to say that residencies such as Art Farm have helped me enormously in that respect. Of course, every writer's needs are different, but I happen to be the type who thrives on a community of other serious artists. Art Farm is most definitely a place that fosters a strong sense of community and invites sharing, whether that means folks sharing their work for critique, cooking communal meals, or introducing one another to new books, music, and films. Ed Dady, the director of Art Farm, has done a fantastic job of helping cultivate an atmosphere that is once nurturing and kind, but also deeply challenging, as the great solitude of the prairie really forces some deep introspection. Although I'd visited not too long ago Nebraska for another residency at the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts in Nebraska City, nothing could prepare me for life on the prairie. The living accommodations served to implant one deep inside of nature, as the barns we slept and worked inside could be described as dilapidated to be kind. Often we had a full range of insects and the occasional toad and bird sharing our living quarters. Sounds like Florida. I even grew to love Bucket the farm cat, despite being initially put off by a serious mood disorder and vindictive tendency to stalk only those residents who were desperately allergic to him. There was also a work exchange element involved at Art Farm. Residents are expected to spend 12 hours a week helping with chores around the farm. Some folks honed their carpentry skills by assisting in extensive building projects to expand rooms and studios off the residential barns. I myself got up on the roof once to help put in a window, but most of my duties focused more on preparing building materials for future construction. I even fed the chickens. Residents were also encouraged to assist other artists on their projects that needed manpower. I was fortunate enough to help with the construction of the Temple of Vesta for my friend, the immensely talented sculptor and installation artist, A.V. Ryan. Her Temple of Vesta partially takes its inspiration from the ancient Tempio de Vesta in Rome and is meant to be a source of good harmonious energy and inspiration for Art Farm and its residents. The site's construction already had a great start and should be completed by next June. Outside of the exchange with other artists, my residency at Art Farm allowed me to indulge in a finite privilege of time where I focused mostly on expanding my novel, The Hunger Saint, and I was able to rework both the plot outline and first 100 pages of the book. I also made headway on a few shorter pieces. One of the great gifts of doing work in an artist residency is having the time not only to make progress on larger works, but also to have the space to play. Experimentation and failure are just important to the process as producing work that is successful and true to your artistic vision. I will be honest, Art Farm is definitely unique among other residencies in how rural and perhaps even a little adventurous it is, but I highly recommend it, especially if you are coming from more urban dwellings. That being said, I do have some small advice for future residents who may venture off Art Farm to indulge in a little more conventional fun at local fairs and bars. Avoid eating the gizzards. Sounds like very sound advice, Olivia. Absolutely avoid the gizzards. Well, that's all the mail we have this week. What's that, Lauren?
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
I'd like to thank Nikita Brotman for a wonderful interview, J.J. Anselmi for a great essay, and you, dear listeners, for putting me into your head once more. Until next week, keep your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Don't swallow the worm.
Don't swallow the worm.
Don't swallow the worm.